So I want to present some recent results of X-ray emission from supernovae based on Chandra X-MM Swift observations. Just to give an idea what the status is right now, over the past 25 years, we have detected 24 supernovae X-rays. So we have approximately one detection per year, very low rate. And the X-ray luminosities range typically from 10 to the 34 arcs per second for very weak supernovae like 1987A, up to some 10 to the 41 arcs per second for the most luminous supernovae. And approximately half of all new detections of supernovae come basically from a very strong program that we have for Chandra. XMM only resulted in one new detection of an X-ray emitting supernova, and that was only marginally. But we have a very strong program with XMM Newton to follow up on the long-term X-ray light curves of supernovae I'm going to talk about here also. And of course, since SWIFT is like the perfect instrument to observe supernova due to its fast response and multi-wavelength coverage, SWIFT is going to play a major role in the future of detecting new X-ray emitting supernovae and following up of them in the UV and X-rays. You all know the geometry. You have like a star that is exploding into its stellar wind. And basically, you have two emission regions. You have the forward shock, given here in red, that produces predominantly like hard X-rays, radio, and UV emission. And the hard X-rays are from shock-heated stellar wind at approximately 10 to the 9 Kelvin. And the reverse shock on the other side gives you a softer X-ray spectrum at approximately 10 to the 7 Kelvin. And to give an idea of what we can do with our X-ray data, if you assume that most of the CSM was deposited by the stellar wind of the progenitor star, then you have the continuum equation that requires basically that the massless rate of the progenitor star is something like the product of the wind density times the wind velocity. And the thermal X-ray luminosity of the shock-heated plasma is just a product of the emission measures, a function of temperature, element abundance, and the energy range you're considering here, times electron ion densities over a certain volume that the shock is probing. So you can plug equation 1 into 2, and then you get to the circumstellar matter interaction luminosity that basically says that if you measure the X-ray luminosity at a certain time t, you can directly measure the massless rate of the planetary star. Here's an example, a recent observation of M100 and supernova 1979C. Here you see the BU and UVW1 band optical monitor image on board XMM Newton. And we detect the supernova in the BU and UV wavelength even like 23 years after the outburst, significant late times after the outburst. On the right-hand side is an X-ray image with XMM Newton, color-coded according to its energy. Soft is like red, medium X-ray band is in green, and the hard X-ray band is in blue. And you see that even 23 years after the outburst, the supernova is still one of the brightest sources inside the galaxy. And here's a very recent SWIFT observation we've obtained just a couple of weeks ago. So we're talking here about an observation 26 years after the outburst of the supernova. And this is an optical three-color band image, V, B, and U band. And you see that there's a faint source still within the aperture centered on the supernova, still detected in all six filters with the UV. And I just also overlaid a circle here where it's a supernova 2006X that was discovered last night. And we're going to have a SWIFT observation tonight, so probably tomorrow I can show you new data if I'm fast enough. And this is the UV three-band image with a SWIFT UBOT instrument. You see here basically a three-color image in the three UV filters that you have. And you see also that 26 years after the outburst, you still detect the supernova in UV. And the X-ray image drawn to scale looks like this. Basically, the supernova is still 26 years after the outburst, the brightest X-ray source within the galaxy M100 here. And we can construct now the long-term X-ray light curve of that supernova, because we have very long-term monitoring with ROSA, ASCA, XMM, Chandra, and now SWIFT. Latest SWIFT data point isn't plotted here. But what we see basically here is that the supernova doesn't show any kind of evolution at all over like a period of between 16 and 26 years after the outburst. It's a very constant X-ray luminosity, very high, 8 times 10 to the 38 arcs per second. And if we plot now the massless rate of the progenitor star as a function of time before the explosion in 10 to 3 years here, then we have to have an a priori knowledge of the shock front velocity. And we have here we are lucky because we have VLBI radio measurements of the shock front velocity. Unfortunately, there were two papers that come to contradicting like results. One paper says that the shock front was a constant shock front, and the other paper says there was a strongly decelerated shock front. So you have here both models. In black, you see basically plotted the model where you assume that the shock front was not decelerated, was a free expansion of the shock. And the gray data points assume that you have a very strong decelerated shock front from initially 16,000 kilometers per second to like 9,000 kilometers per second 20 years after the outburst. But in any case, you get to the same conclusion, that is that the mass loss rate of the progenitor star has not changed over a period of more than 20,000 years before the explosion of the star. And as I said before, here's the X-ray Newton image, and here is the Swift-Ewart image. We detect the supernova also in the BU and all UV bands, which means basically that we have independent confirmation that there's very strong circumstellar interaction going on from those wavelength bands also. And we know that most of the flux is from the supernova itself because we have HST imaging of the environment of the supernova, and we can estimate how much flux is from the supernova and how much is from neighboring stars. And just to summarize, on this particular supernova, we observe a very high X-ray luminosity of almost 10 to 30 nanometers per second, even 26 years after the outburst. We don't observe any kind of evolution over a period of between 16 and 26 years after the outburst. And we measure a high, very high and constant mass loss rate of approximately 2 × 10⁻⁴ solar masses per year over a period of 20,000 years in the history of the progenitor star. And spectral analysis of the X-ray Newton data shows that the spectrum can be best fit with a two-component thermal plasma model with a low temperature component of approximately 0.8 kV, which is assumed to be from the reverse soft shock front that contributes to like 64% of the X-ray flux. And we have a higher temperature component of around 4 kiloelectron volt from the forward shock. And the high BU and UV bands and also R bands from NDM observations flux indicates that we have substantial CSM interaction here, independent of the X-rays. And here's an observation with X-Men Newton, a target opportunity observation of M51 and supernova 2005 CS in M51 that we did not detect in X-rays, but we detected it in all optical monitor filters. Here's an optical image. Here's an ultraviolet image of the galaxy. And we only have a 3 sigma upper limit to the X-ray flux, X-ray luminosity of some 10 to the 37 ergs per second at 3 days after the outburst, which indicates that the mass loss rate of the progenitor star was smaller than 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. And I should mention here, this is not an exception. We only detect, a good estimate is that we only detect between 2 and 3% of all supernovae in X-rays. So this is... Say again? That was type 2N, I believe. 2P? Oh, okay. Type 2. And this is, on the left-hand side, a three-color Chandra image, a very deep observation, almost 200 kiloseconds of the Edgeon galaxy, 3877. And this is supernova 1998S. At a period of approximately 2.4 years after the outburst, has very high X-ray luminosity of more than 10 to 39 ergs per second. On the right-hand side, you see an X-Men Newton image 3.1 years after the outburst, and you see that the X-ray flux has significantly declined to 1.5 times 10 to 39 ergs per second. And if you do a spectral analysis of here on the left-hand side, you see the ACES spectrum of the supernova. Here on the right-hand side, you see the X-Men Newton spectrum. Because we have 5 individual pointings on that supernova with Chandra alone and later an X-Men Newton observation, we can study the temporal evolution of the spectrum of the supernova. And we see a possible softening of the emission as is actually expected from circumstellar interaction models from a harder component from the forward shock to a softer component as the expanding shell becomes optically thin, and then reverse shock emission basically dominates the emission. So the Chandra observations indicate an initial hard spectrum of 10 kV, later it softened to 8 kV, and the X-Men Newton is best characterized like 3.1 years after the outburst by a 5 or 6 kV thermoplasma spectrum, or equally well by a 2 temperature thermoplasma component with a soft component of 0.8 kV from the reverse shock and an 8 kV component from the forward shock. And this is a Chandra observation of the galaxy M101, face-on galaxy, and this is a 1 megasecond exposure time. This is one of the most sensitive X-ray observations ever on a nearby galaxy. You see a large amount of diffuse emission from the galaxy. You see literally hundreds of point sources in the galaxy. And due to the high resolution of the Chandra ACES instrument, we were able to recover X-ray emission from supernova 1970G 35 years after the outburst, which makes it the oldest of the young supernovae that we detect in X-rays. With a luminosity of 10 to the 37 X per second at an age of 35 years after the outburst. And since we have the good spatial resolution of the Chandra ACES instrument, we can now go back to archival data and recover the supernova and ROSA observations. And I created an X-ray light curve of that supernova that shows a rather steep X-ray rate of decline with theta minus S with an index of 2.7. And this is the mass flow rate history of supernova 1970G in M101. And you see also in this case that the progenitor star had a constant mass flow rate of around 3 times 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year over a period of more than 30,000 years prior to the explosion. With SWIFT, we are now starting to have a very strong program in observing supernovae because SWIFT, due to its fast response paired with the broadband wavelength coverage, is just the perfect instrument to do these kind of studies. So to date, we've been observing 16 supernovae with SWIFT. 9 of those are type 1A, 7 are core collapse supernovae, and 6 of them have very good sample light curves. And tomorrow's going to be 17. Supernova 2006X. Here's ultraviolet image with the SWIFT UWIRD instruments and the three UV filters on board SWIFT of supernova 2005 KE that we've been observing extensively from 6 days after the outburst, which was mid-November, and we're still observing it right now. We had more than 50 individual observations up to date. And we detect the supernova in all wavelength bands with the optical monitor, with the UWIRD instrument. And on the right-hand side, you see the merged XRT X-ray image of supernova 2005 KE, which is a type 1A supernova, I should stress here. And you see here, within the aperture centered on the position of the supernova, we in fact detect an X-ray source at the position of the supernova. So this gives at least marginal evidence that we have detected the first type 1A supernova in X-rays. And we can infer the mass loss rate, which is 8 times 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, and measure the CSM density to be 8 times 10 to the 7 per square per cubic centimeter at a distance of some 10 to the 15 centimeters from the site of the explosion. And I also rebind the 258 kilosecond XRT data into 5 consecutive time bins to study the temporal evolution of the X-ray emission. And even though statistically this is consistent with showing no evolution, there's at least some indication that the X-ray flux might have increased over time. And if you believe in this, there might be indications that there was no production of X-rays prior to 30, 35 days after the explosion, which might give indications that either the expanding shell was optically thick and no X-rays could leak out, or simply that there was no circumstellar matter present at a radius of smaller than 3 times 10 to the 15 centimeters from the site of the explosion. So this might give evidence for a circumstellar matter gap in the vicinity of the supernova. And here you see the 6 SWIFT UWAT filter light curve of this type 1A supernova 2005 KE. The three top light curves are in the optical band, VB and U band, and the solid lines are basically type 1A light curve templates. And you see that the supernova follows the standard templates as expected for type 1A. But as you go to shorter wavelengths, it becomes obvious that there's an excess of emission for this type 1A supernova with respect to type 1A templates, especially if you go see here this blue one. Blue is UVW1 filter. You see here significant excess of UV emission with respect to type 1A templates, starting also at 35 days after the outburst. And of course, the UV emission, we believe, is also produced by circumstellar interaction. In this case, in the UVW1 band, by the magnesium 2 emission line at 280 nanometers near the peak of the sensitivity of this filter. which gives independent evidence, in addition to our X-ray detection, if you believe in that, that we have indeed detected this substantial circumstellar interaction for this type 1a supernova. And this is the UV-like curve of all type 1a supernovae that we've been observed so far with SWIFT, and we hope that we're going to add much more to that. But what is very interesting is that the shapes of the UV-like curves of type 1a supernovae are surprisingly similar. So by just shifting these light curves vertically, you get a perfect match to those light curves. And this gives at least hope or indication that we might be able to establish type 1a supernovae as standard candles in the ultraviolet, which has never been done before. And it has large implications for cosmology, because if you want to observe high redshift type 1a supernovae, you have to take into account that the ultraviolet emission might be redshifted into visual or even into the infrared band. So you have to be able to understand the UV light curves of type 1a supernovae if you want to use them as cosmological probes. And this is what we're doing here with SWIFT. We're setting up a very large program now to establish them as standard candles in the ultraviolet. And I overplot now here with the star symbol supernova 2005 KE, this oddball that we've been observing. And you see here in the UVW1 filter this excess of UV emission. So this is the only one that we saw that has an excess in the UV, but not in the optical filters. So to summarize 2005 KE, we have the first detection of circumstellar matter interaction for type 1a supernova in X-rays. And we have independent confirmation from the detection of a UV excess for the supernova, which gives an independent, like a direct evidence of a companion star in that system, because the white dwarf lacks a significant stellar wind to produce circumstellar interaction. So we believe that the circumstellar interaction is basically the shock running into the wind of the companion star system, which of course is a fundamental assumption of all type 1a models, that they live in binary systems. And we can measure the massless rate and the circumstellar matter density around the supernova. Massless rate is some 8 times 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. CSM density of 8 times 10 to the 7 per cubic centimeters. And if you put this into context, this is a selected sample I had time to work on recently of the circumstellar matter density profiles for a number of supernovae. Most of them are type 2, except for 2005 KE. Then you see basically that each of these supernovae is following an R to the minus T, R to the minus 2 profile, as expected for a stellar wind profile. So nothing surprising there, basically. And this is the data point for the type 1a supernova, which shows basically that the circumstellar density is very high for the supernova, not as expected, because we detected in X-rays. But it's not unreasonably high, and it's still within the range of core collapse supernovae that show a stellar wind profile. And my last slide is on the X-ray light curves of all X-ray supernovae so far. So on the left-hand side, you see all 24 supernovae we've detected in X-rays. We only plotted the first and the last data point for every supernova, because we literally have like hundreds of data points here. And on the right-hand side, you see the X-ray luminosities of supernova remnants, like old supernova remnants, up to like thousands of years. And of course, you have here at the faint end supernova 87A that didn't produce any significant X-ray emission up to 10 years after the outburst, until the shock was hitting the ring we heard before, and now it's getting brighter up to next year, and then it will decline again when it leaves the ring. And what is also very interesting is, even though we are lacking significant data here in this intermediate age supernovae that I would like to fill up with Chandra and XMM observations, you have your clear indications that, for instance, if you extrapolate the light curve of supernova 1993J, for instance, it will automatically evolve into a luminous supernova remnant like Cas A without the need of the shock having to hit like interstellar material. Which is very interesting, because you can extrapolate those light curves, and if you just follow them, you will produce all those luminous supernova remnants, and there's absolutely no need for any interaction with interstellar material at all. So just to summarize here, with SWIFT, you're having a large program now to observe as many type 1a supernovae as you can, to establish them as standard candles in the ultraviolet. And we would like to have as many new detections in X-rays as possible to learn more about the environments and the progenitor systems. And as a spin-off product, of course, we get all these fantastic ultraviolet observations of nearby galaxies. And we should keep in mind here that the newer instrument aboard SWIFT has a much better spatial resolution than GALAX, for instance, at least factor two better, much higher sensitivity than the optical monitor on board Exmor-Newton. And we have a larger field of view than the HST, which means we will probably come up with a very nice catalog of galaxies in the ultraviolet, which has never been done before, which is a perfect legacy project also to study, for instance, time variability of all sources in ultraviolet in those galaxies, or to look for counterparts of ultraluminous X-ray sources, because most of those galaxies also have ultraluminous X-ray sources. And you can just look at the U-bot data and fish out the optical candidates. Thank you.
So thanks for the review. So this proves that SWIFT is doing great work on a number of sources, on non-GRB sources. I have a question. There is a question, Vikram.
Hi, I was really surprised by your result on 79C. If I remember correctly from the radio, and maybe Skylar or someone can correct me, 79C showed like almost a sinusoidal sort of this thing in the radio, like oscillations for a long time. And I mean, they've interpreted it as density, where it may not be, but I'm just saying that I was surprised that the X-ray was so.
Well, first of all, right. I mean, there were some indications for sinusoidal modulations, but I was never convinced that they were real in a way, right? But
maybe we can ask the radio people.
Certainly don't have the sampling rate so you can probe them, right? We only get an observation per year or so, and these variations appear to be on much shorter time scales. So if they're not able to see them in X-rays, because we only have like 4 or 5 data points.
I think they were more than, Yeah, it was very different in the radio, so I was just very surprised by your conclusions.
Yeah, we'll see. I have to add, I didn't add the latest SWIFT XRT data point to this plot yet. So we'll see. Maybe if it has brightened again, I would be very surprised. We'll have another observation tonight. And I also have a Chandra observation next week, a very deep one, and then we'll finally know. But as I said, we only have like 4 or 5 data points on that particular supernova in X-rays. And there's no indication for any kind of evolution at all. Maybe because we simply don't have the sampling rate of our data points.
Can you go back to that sort of mother of all X-ray light curves plot?
Sorry.
You know, the one with the remnants?
Yes.
And can you point out where KE would lie?
KE? No, I haven't put that in yet.
So, yeah, where would it be?
It was, what was the X-ray luminosity? I believe it's somewhere here.
Did it?
Yes.
Okay. So I was going to just mention that, you know, there is no radio detection associated with this event. And most of the strong X-ray emitters generally have at least some detectable radio emission, especially if there's strong circumstellar interaction. So it is a little bit puzzling.
Do you have the sensitivity to detect it?
Yeah.
Because it's very faint, actually.
Yes. Sure. But it would be interesting. I mean, it would be unusual to have.
Well, we have a Chandra TOO next week on that supernova, and that will probably further show if this X-ray detection is real or not.
Yeah.
Because I, in all honesty, this is only like between 3 and 3.5 sigma detection, right? So it's a very low significance.
Right.
Take one more question.
You said in the case of 2005 KE, you could estimate the mass of the companion star. How did you do that?
Actually, no, I'm not able to estimate it. I mean, it's certainly, the mass loss rate is not very high, right? It's probably more in the range of less than 10 solar masses.
But how did you, how can you estimate the mass of the companion star?
I cannot without talking to our theoreticians here.
But that's what you, in your conclusion slide, that's what you wrote, right?
No, I didn't estimate the mass of the companion star. All I'm saying is basically, that the progenitor of a type 1a supernova is a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf, right? And that is just lacking significant stellar wind to produce this circumstellar interaction. So there has to be a more massive companion star where the wind comes from.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's all I can say.
I think we have to stop the discussion here. So thanks again for the very nice results. And we move.